how candidates favored by the Tea Party are setting the table for 2016. That's The Case, made by a Jacksonville author. He takes your calls just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And this morning, we're talking politics as the Democrats debate tonight in Las Vegas, just as a UNF author argues the Tea Party is driving the debate on the Republican side. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, honoring the legacy of the late Dr. Chester Akins, we'll tell you about a special award and the pro bono work of Florida Coastal School of Law. Plus, meet the winner of WJCT's The Square, showcasing the work of local artists. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders face off tonight in the first debate for the Democratic presidential candidates heading into the 2016 election. It's a far less crowded field than the Republican Party, where two raucous debates have been dominated by the attention focused on outsider candidates like Donald Trump, Carly Fiorina, and Ben Carson. In a new book, a UNF professor argues that the Tea Party wing of the GOP has eclipsed the traditional Republican establishment this election cycle, and that shift is being felt as both parties seek the ultimate prize, the White House. Dr. Ronald Libby, UNF political science professor and author of the new book, Purging the Republican Party, Tea Party Campaigns and Elections, is on the line now. Dr. Libby, a pleasure. Good morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And here's our question to callers. Whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent, we want your thoughts on the 2016 election. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. We're already getting your comments there. In a moment, Dr. Libby, we have so much to discuss because there's a lot happening in the headlines. But first, when it comes to your book, it's the first book, as you say, that explains the Tea Party's strategy to do what they call primarying, mounting candidates against Republicans that they see as not sufficiently true to their principles. Beginning with local and congressional races, you argue in this book that they've taken that strategy from local races to the national stage, correct?
Yes. They started the first primary that they carried out was in 2009 in upstate New York against Didi Scarsifava. It's the 23rd district, and that district had voted Republican for over 100 years. And so the establishment put up a so-called moderate or liberal Republican to run for that district, and that triggered a reaction from Tea Party groups all around the country. And so they descended in the small town, Watertown, began to campaign against her and essentially drove her out. The entire establishment, Republican establishment in D.C., made campaign contributions that included Boehner and all the other leading Republicans without getting the support of local Republican Party leaders and Republican voters, essentially. And so that set the pattern, and they copied that, and now it happens throughout the country. So you've got thousands of these local Tea Party groups or organizations throughout the country, and you've got millions of followers, and they're basically a virtual community, you might say.
Sure. And as we see this playing out at the national level, you see Donald Trump and Ben Carson as most accurately reflecting the values of this wing of the Republican Party. Just the other day, Donald Trump indicated that should he start to slide in the polls, he would exit the race. What are your thoughts about that? Because Trump still leads all polls on the Republican side.
Yeah, I can't. At this point, I can't see him bowing out unless, of course, his campaign implodes. But that's true of any campaign. Any candidate in any campaign. So I don't know that that's unique. It's just that he garners so much attention that anything he says or doesn't say is magnified. So I don't see him at this point. I don't see him pulling out.
And who do you see winning the GOP nomination? We've all learned this morning that Las Vegas casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, who threw his money behind Newt Gingrich in 2012, is going to support Marco Rubio for president, a big boost to Senator Rubio, Florida. Do you think that will enable Marco Rubio to rise to the top of the GOP field? You see him as garnering significant Tea Party support as well.
Well, actually, not.
No? Okay.
No. I mean, he was elected with Tea Party support. The Republican Party turned its back on him. So he essentially garnered the support of Tea Party. There are about 210 Tea Party groups throughout Florida. And essentially, he went from one group to another throughout the state and built support that way. It got press attention and ultimately got the backing. And Chris was defeated in the primary. He wasn't defeated, you know, before or after. But so that's how he got into the Senate. And then when he got to the Senate, he essentially turned his back on the Tea Party. I mean, he refused, for example, to join the Tea Party caucus in the Senate. And then he took on the role of leading the so-called Gang of Eight senators in the Senate, pushing comprehensive immigration reform, which included a form of executive amnesty and not sealing the border first. So basically he lost that support. So I don't care. I mean, that's what's unique about Trump and Carson is that they're not supported by the establishment. Mega corporations are not behind them. The Chamber of Commerce is not behind them. The Chamber of Commerce and these large corporations are essentially, and the Koch brothers, they're all behind the rhinos now. So, and that would include Rubio now, because he basically has turned into an establishment politician. And I think that's the reason he's sinking in the polls. He's only down to something like 6% now.
And by RINO, the acronym for Republican in name only, we're speaking right now to Dr. Ronald Libby, UNF political science professor, author of the new book, Purging the Republican Party, Tea Party Campaigns and Elections. Let us know your thoughts on the Tea Party's influence on 2016. The Democratic debate is tonight in Las Vegas. We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. So do you see the Tea Party's influence then as a positive or a negative on the party? Because as we're seeing on Capitol Hill right now, as John Boehner exits Congress, congressional Republicans are having a difficult time finding someone to replace him. Deep divisions between the so-called establishment Republicans and the more Tea Party-aligned Republicans on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I see the Tea Party as a positive force because it's a democratizing trend, actually, sweeping the country. It's grassroots. I mean, who can be against democracy? I think it's a very healthy thing. I think what we have had decades now is top-down sort of policy making without taking into account the views of voters. So this is inverted. It's just the opposite now. It's coming from below, not from the top. So basically the leadership of the Republican Party can no longer handpick the candidates, you know, and mount campaigns. It's the Tea Party that's taking control. It's become the base of the Republican Party.
And when do you think that shift occurred? As you write in your book, the 2009 movement emerged shortly after Barack Obama's election with the rant on the Wall Street trading floor, or maybe it was the Chicago Board of Trade. I can't remember.
Yeah, Chicago Board of Trade.
Yeah.
Rick Santelli.
Yeah. At what point do you think that shift, that sort of co-opting or that metamorphosis of the party took place, whereby this grassroots movement became the overall base of the party?
Right. Well, it was galvanized by Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act. And I don't know if you remember, but in the summer of 2009, at a series of town hall meetings throughout the country, folks began to speak up and challenge of all things, Republicans in Congress, because Republicans didn't sponsor it, they didn't vote for it. Not a single Republican voted for that. And yet they were challenging them, the leaders of the Republican Party. So that's when it galvanized. And then they began to organize, and then the movement became a political force, you might say, at that point. And it's taken a couple of years to sort of develop a more sophisticated platform and candidate selection, and so they've advanced quite rapidly since 2009.
And what do you think about the Tea Party's influence on elections? We'll go to your calls in a moment as we speak to author Ron Libby at 549-2937. Let me ask you as well, Ron, if the ultimate goal is to win the White House, what's your response to the argument that the Tea Party is holding back Republican hopes when you look at the electoral math in a general election? If the Republican Party has to mount a general election candidate that can win the so-called traditional blue states, and a candidate that will have to take more moderate positions on contentious issues like immigration, say, that has to attract younger voters, African-American voters, Latino voters, women voters, gay and lesbian voters, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think of the argument that the Tea Party's influence is pulling the Republican Party too far to the right for them to win back the White House?
No, I don't see that at all. And I think it's a fundamentally inaccurate description, essentially, of the Tea Party. That is to say, the Tea Party is not Republican. These are not Republicans. They're independents, including Democrats, and they're willing to go against the leadership of the Republican Party. And the two candidates that are leading right now on the Republican side are Trump and Carson, and they basically are not Republicans. I mean, one of the first things that Carson had to do before he entered the race was to register as a Republican. So both of them, both Carson and Trump, have been Democrats and independents. And that's the Tea Party. I mean, 4 out of 10 Tea Party activists are not Republicans. And even the ones who say they're Republicans are prepared to vote against the Republican candidates. So, and both of them, Carson and Trump, have crossover appeal. That's the reason they're doing so well. I mean, Trump is polling about 19% of Democrats in these surveys.
And do you see the immigration issue as the overriding driver behind that?
No, actually, you see, the Tea Party has got its own platform. It is called the Contract from America, and they developed this through a series of voting exercises involving about 500,000 Tea Party activists. And that's not one of the planks, you might say, or principles of the Tea Party contract. The significance of that, executive amnesty, basically is it's a constitutionally overreaching action. That is to say, it's outside, from the point of view of the Tea Party, it's outside the boundaries of the Constitution. So they're concerned about that. So I mean, it just happens that this has come up, but it's not necessarily because of immigration itself. I mean, again, if you look at the contract, I can quickly read these things if you want to know what they are.
Sure, sure.
Okay, number one is protect the Constitution. So they want constitutionally limited government. Right? Two is reject cap and trade, because that's the global warming thing. Three, demand a balanced budget. Four, enact fundamental tax reform. Five, restore fiscal responsibility and constitutionally limited government. Six, end runaway government spending. Seven, defund, repeal, and replace government-run health care. Eight, pass an all-of-the-above energy policy. Nine, stop the pork. And 10, stop the tax hike. There's nothing in there on social issues, gay marriage, abortion, immigration, or any of those things. It's just that they think that president's action is a violation of the Constitution as it was originally envisioned by the founders. And they also think that Congress has surrendered its constitutional obligation to check the power of the executive. That's what they're concerned about.
And the number to join the show is 549-2937. Let's go to a few of your social media comments. Here's one from JP on our Facebook page. The reason for John Boehner's downfall is he wanted to get business done, but the Tea Party wanted everything their way. Republicans in Congress could have brought bills on jobs, infrastructure, immigration reform, tax reform, but instead they chose to waste their time on the impossible, like repealing Obamacare and pointless investigations. The GOP has been hijacked by a fringe who don't understand how government works or what kind of policies have been or are needed if we're going to be successful. What about that argument, Ron Libby?
Well, I don't agree with it at all. And I don't think the Tea Party sees it that way. I mean, you have to understand there are kind of three fundamental positions or policy positions that Boehner and the establishment have adopted. One of them is to accept Obamacare and to reject any attempt to revoke it. That's the first one. The second one is embrace what the Tea Party calls executive amnesty. That's to relax immigration, especially in the southern border. And the third one is Common Core. Those are three planks, you might say, that of the establishment, the Republican establishment. And you think of Jeb Bush in this regard because he reflects that, those views. And the same is true of Marco Rubio. Mm. Okay, so what is the significance of that? The Chamber of Commerce supports those three items, those policy items, and the Koch brothers have embraced that. And the Karl Rove-funded or sponsored American Crossroads Super PAC has embraced all that. That's where the big money is, those three things. And so why do they do that? Because they want government to absorb the cost of health care. That takes the burden off them so they can be more competitive in international markets. And they want a larger labor pool, and they want them educated, the labor pool educated, with skills they need. So it makes sense from the point of view of big business, but I don't think it makes sense in terms of, say, a limited government controlling out of control spending, limiting deficit spending, driving up the national debt, any of that. And also, it's certainly not limited government, constitutionally limited government. So that's what they're fighting over. And Boehner supports those three things. The Tea Party is against those three things.
All right, lots of calls now. Let's go to your thoughts. Lisa in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a little confused, I guess, on how Tea Party connects with the Freedom Caucus, because I kind of had, in my brain, had sort of had them in a similar dysfunctional capacity in terms of what's going on right now, not only nationally, but in the state of Florida, in terms of government being shut down more or less, or not, you know, being able to function properly because of being to the extreme right and pandering to kind of more extremist base voters that tend to think that nobody is far right enough. And so I kind of wanted to have him explain that if he could, please.
Thank you, Lisa.
Okay, about the Freedom Caucus. Well, the Freedom Caucus is essentially the Tea Party. That's a shorthand way of talking about it. Because, I mean, the chair of the Freedom Caucus is about 40 members. It's Jim Jordan from Ohio, and he was a former Tea Party activist. Because they had a Tea Party caucus in the House. Michelle Bachmann and Steve King from Iowa, the co-sponsors of that caucus. And they're still there, but they basically become more influential in the so-called Freedom Caucus. But I mean, if you talk about rationality, how rational is it to drive up the national debt to $19 trillion? That's more than our GDP. How rational is it to have trillion-dollar deficits every year? I mean, look at Western Europe. I mean, look at Greece. I mean, That's totally irrational. I mean, you can't keep spending money you don't have.
Well, let me ask you, though, Ron, as a follow-up. Here's a recent editorial that just ran in the Wall Street Journal, conservative publication, and the editorial writer opines, the GOP's disarray and accusations of an ungovernable House suggest that the Freedom Caucus has overplayed its hand. Major issues looming before Congress include the debt limit, funding the federal government beyond mid-December, a party that shows itself incapable of governing or managing its own affairs, threatens its congressional and White House prospects in 2016, which means the Freedom Caucus's actions could end up undermining the conservative cause its members hold so dear.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a Rhino point of view. This is the establishment speaking. From the point of view of the Tea Party, the grassroots democratic reform movement, they don't really care who is, who happens to be in power, as long as they continue with this out of control spending and national debt. So, I mean, that's the whole point.
But isn't really that burning down the village in order to sit? I mean, you've got to be able to govern. You've got to be able to pass a budget. You've got to be able to pass a governing agenda.
Well, again, but I mean, it's a little bit like saying, you need to cooperate if you're going to go over the cliff together. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, from the point of view of fiscally responsible, constitutionally limited citizens. I mean, why collaborate with something that's destructive? And that's their point of view. Besides, when you say, well, they need to compromise, what does that mean? Remember, I mentioned a Common Core, Obamacare, and basically relaxed or open immigration policy. I mean, how is that going to enhance the welfare and security of the country? It doesn't. From their point of view, it doesn't.
All right, let's go now to Scott on the South Side. Hi, Scott. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
I am a lifelong Democrat, and I just want to thank this guy and every member of the Tea Party. I mean, you listen to him ramble on and on and on about fiscal responsibility, and I'd really like to hear his view on Reagan, so he can just totally split the party in half. It's belligerent. It's obscene. These people could never govern. They're running around hugging guns and wearing tinfoil hats. 70% of non-discretionary funding goes to the military. If you want to do anything about government spending, you've got to go after the military. If you're not going to do that, if you're just whining about health care, which has actually been making money, Obamacare has been. If you want to just whine about welfare or whine about immigration, you're just rambling about nothing. It's ridiculous, but I do want to thank him for helping keep a few of the bad guys out of office, because that's what he'll be doing next year. Thanks.
All right, Ron.
Well, most of the budget essentially goes for so-called entitlements. I mean, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It's about 70% of it. So when we talk about military spending, you're talking about 5 to 6% of GDP. So it really is not the 800-pound gorilla that some people like to make it out. It's basically the entitlements. And we have to address that. But, I mean, running these trillion-dollar deficits every year doesn't solve anything. And it aggravates. It makes it worse. And I think, and so the waste and abuse and out of control spending is the thing that's driving this. Also, as I mentioned to you, they're very concerned about, limited constitutional government and the fact that the Congress has rolled over and it's not performing its duty, basically, to check the power of the executive.
Well, actually, I do have to correct you. According to the Office of Management and Budget, by far the biggest mandatory spending is military, followed by entitlements and then other pieces of the pie. And that is from the OMB website. Year 2015, the federal budget was $3.8 trillion.
Right. But Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are the two largest budget items.
Alrighty.
There's no doubt about that.
All right. Let's go now to Richard in Riverside. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Go ahead.
I wanted to take issue with your speaker's contention that the Tea Party is a grassroots movement. From what I can see, they get their money overwhelmingly from the Koch brothers and PACs like this. It doesn't come from small contributors the way Bernie Sanders does, for example. I also want to take issue with his contention that Tea Party contains a significant number of Democrats. This just isn't so. I haven't seen any signs of it. I've never heard a Democrat that I know of say that they've become a Tea Party activist in any way, shape, or form. The fact is that I think the Tea Party has a nascent stream of racism in it. It was galvanized by the election of Obama, and he continues to be almost the sole focus of their attacks. I don't know if your author intended to present himself as even-handed, but I see him as an advocate for the Tea Party, and so many of the things that he says as facts, I have to take as a grain of salt. He completely ignores the fact that the $19 trillion deficit was made in large part necessary by the spending and the lack of income associated with the crash of 2008, which was wholly a product of George Bush's policies and some of the things that were allowed to go on. So I find, this author not really credible, and many of the things that he says is not believable.
Richard, thanks for the call. Ron?
Well, the only thing I could say is that there are thousands of these Tea Party organizations in the country as a whole. There were over 200 of them in Florida. I would suggest that the caller attend one of the meetings and actually get to know these people. There's survey data on this. We know basically pretty much what they are. And I don't know if the caller is anywhere near Jacksonville, but, I mean, the First Coast Tea Party is very influential here in Jacksonville. They have regular meetings. And if you think they're racist, why don't you attend one of their meetings, and then you'll find out.
Are you a member?
No.
What?
But I have attended their meetings,
mm-hmm.
and I've been in touch with Tea Party groups all over the country. But these are ordinary citizens, and many of them are independents, some have been former Democrats, some Republicans, but they're opposed to the policies that are followed by the leadership of the Republican Party.
And so if you had to make a prediction, who do you think will win the nomination on the Republican side, given what the themes and ideas you've laid out in your book?
Right. Can I back up a little bit and just make a comment about funding? If you go to one of the meetings, they basically take up collections with a plate, a basket, and they are absolutely self-funding. And I know that the charge made that the Koch brothers and their Americans for Prosperity are funding. There's no support for that at all. None. And now back to the question. I think that, the polls are probably the best indicator of where we are right now. And, obviously things can change. But the two leading candidates, three of the top five are all Tea Party. So Ted Cruz, Tea Party, Trump, Tea Party, and Carson, Tea Party. They have crossover appeal. I mean, Carson, for example, their strategists, they think that he can garner about 20% of the black vote. It crosses over. I mean, they're solidly Democratic, so he would get some black vote. And Trump, he was a former Democrat, independent, and he attracts some Democrats, maybe up to 20%. So it's going to have to be a candidate who can cross over into, the Democratic voting bloc, somebody like that. That's the problem that Rand Paul has. He has not expanded beyond his father's constituency, Ron Paul,
yeah.
The libertarians.
And
remains
And we're out of time, but thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
All right. And he's author and UNF professor Ron Libby joining us. Later, meet the top vote getter in WJCT's The Square. But up next, a special award honoring the legacy of the late Chester Akins. We're back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of a right-wing religious zealot and the leader he assassinated. We talk with journalist Dan Efron. His new book is about the 1995 assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and the ultra-Orthodox young Jewish man who killed him. Dan Efron served as the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, just before Christmas 2013, civic leader Chester Akins died from a heart attack as he was leaving Jacksonville City Hall. The prominent dentist and advisor to local political leaders was a graduate of Florida Coastal School of Law. Recently, Florida Coastal honored Akins' legacy with a special award and scholarship. Here to tell us more about that and the school's pro bono work, we welcome Sarah Sullivan, director of Florida Coastal's Disability and Public Benefits Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning.
And the winner of the Dr. Chester Akins Renaissance Award, local attorney Rhonda Peoples-Waters. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with you, Rhonda. You are the winner of this award, honoring the legacy of the late Dr. Akins. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What does this mean to you? Because Chester Akins was really a pillar in the community.
Absolutely. It's a great honor. I can tell you that I admired Chester Akins for quite some time afar and got the opportunity to see him a few times in the law school, but largely I saw his presence in the community, and he was a great servant leader. He loved his family, and I would see him often with his family at Jaguars games. So he taught us about volunteerism as well as leading, and how do we do that with integrity.
And how do you see yourself carrying on that example?
Well, it's a very large honor, and it makes me understand every day as I practice law that we have this ability to influence people's lives and also to give of ourselves throughout our volunteerism. I work a lot with Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, and we cooperate with those clinics and giving to those people that are considered the least, and that's what Dr. Akins' memory was about.
Sarah Sullivan, the Florida Coastal School of Law Foundation is trying to carry that through with legal clinics, pro bono legal services for people in the community that cannot afford to pay a lawyer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We have a number of clinics. We have 16 clinics actually operating out of the law school, and six in-house clinics. I'm the director of one of those. And over the past year, our experiential learning programs offered around 140,000 hours of pro bono services to the community. And we really are a safety net of legal services for those underserved populations.
Right. And the White House recently honored this pro bono work. Is that right?
Actually, we received an A-plus in experiential learning from the National Jurist, and that was actually something that deals with the experiential learning programs at large, and that was given to us in February of 2015. And we're very proud of that because it shows that we are a leader among all law schools in our experiential learning.
So people listening that need free legal aid, and there are a lot of them, especially since Jacksonville Area Legal Aid has had to, due to budget cuts, has had to reduce the number of attorneys it has on staff. How can people access this vital service?
Well, usually clients are referred through community agencies. And so, for example, if someone is accessing some kind of service through the community, whether it be through, for example, an immigration client might be receiving services through Catholic Family Charities, we get referrals through Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, we're one of their safety nets. Also through, for example, ARC Jacksonville, or through even some state agencies, they'll get referred to our clinic, and then those individuals are screened for eligibility, and they are offered free legal services and are offered an opportunity to be represented by licensed attorneys as well as students that are learning how to practice law.
Now, the award, the Chester Akins Award, isn't the only honor. There's also a scholarship, Rhonda. Is that right?
Yes, I do understand that there will be prospective students each year that will be able to receive this scholarship in the in Chester Akins honor, so that these students can understand that once they have their law degree, you know, that isn't the end. That's just the beginning of them giving to our community and taking that knowledge and helping those that can afford your services as well as those that may not be able to.
Now, while we've got you here in front of a hot mic, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. You've looked at running for office in the past. Is that something you're considering again in the future?
Absolutely. And that's one of the bonds that I had with Chester Akins. He was one of my greatest supporters. And I'll tell you that I do believe that that's going to be another way that I can continue in his legacy with giving to our community.
What seat are you looking at?
In a judicial seat. So I certainly expect that to be a seat for us in the future.
Well, we'll keep our eyes out for that. In the meantime, kudos. And thanks for being here, both of you.
Thank you.
Sarah Sullivan, Director of Florida Coastal's Disability and Public Benefits Clinic. Rhonda Peoples-Waters, winner of the Dr. Chester Akins Renaissance Award. And much more still ahead. Keep listening.
WJZT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJZT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjzt.org/thesquare.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
My name is Harry Reagan. I got hooked immediately because it's just the kind of radio station I've always been looking for and never found until now.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 or go online to wjct.org/relax for more information.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Some people call him America's storyteller.
If you were the fifth or sixth child, you may have been the child of habit. But if there hadn't been wood ticks, you might have been the fifth out of 24, you see.
Some people call him the Mark Twain of our time.
Our marriage is like the Electoral College. He said it works better if you don't think about it.
Just don't call him on Saturday night because he's throwing a party. Join us, won't you?
A Prairie Home Companion, returning Saturdays at 6.
Welcome back. Well, it's called the White Cane Law. Let me read it to you. It's unlawful for any person, unless totally or partially blind or otherwise incapacitated while on any public street or highway, to carry in a raised or extended position a cane or a walking stick which is white in color or white tipped with red. An event is coming up in town this week to mark 2015 White Cane Safety Day. It's a time to remind all of us to be safe and to look out for people using those white canes on our public streets. There are people who need them because they are of low to no vision. One of them is Jacksonville's Doug Hansard. He's got a white cane. He's here in studio, and he's here to tell us about White Cane Safety Day. Hey, Doug, good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
It's so good to see you.
Thank you.
I just learned about this from you. I had never heard of the white cane law. Unfortunately, it's a little known law in Florida, but we want to raise awareness about it. Let's explain what the white cane law is all about.
White cane law basically comes down to safety. It's a safety issue. We want to be able to alert all motorists that there are pedestrians who not only have white canes, but also service animals, either a guide horse, which I have a friend of mine that has, or a guide dog. And it's about getting from one side of the street safely to the other side. And we want to see this white cane law reintroduced into the driver's manual when people go for their driver's tests. Because evidently, at one point, there was a time when this white cane law was a part of the driver's test, and for whatever reason, it was taken out.
That's too bad. White Cane Safety Day is coming up Thursday. You represent the local council for the blind in Jacksonville. There's going to be a happening, an event outside St. Vincent's Hospital. What's going to take place?
Yes, we're going to actually, we are combining the Jacksonville Council of the Blind, which I am the president of, will be combining along with the National Federation of the Blind. The two local groups will meet at St. Vincent's Hospital on Thursday, October 15th, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. And we're going to take a slow stroll down Riverside Avenue all the way down to the Five Points area. And in regards to that, we are going to be passing out copies of this white cane law so that it would make not only just motorists, but all persons aware of this white cane law.
When you're out and about with your white cane, does it strike up conversations with people? What kind of reactions do you get?
Oh, I get plenty of reactions. Believe it or not, I get one reaction I get is, how do you use that thing? And you see it folded up like it is now. And when I unfold it, sometimes it looks like a nunchuck. I've gotten all kinds of reactions with it. But for years, this is the first time I've had this current cane that I have right now with a rolling tip. And it's the first time that I've used a cane with a rolling tip in the 39 years that I've been visually impaired. And I love it. But, you know, and there's a preference. Some people use service animals. Some people use guide dogs. I just choose to use a white cane. And, you know, it's just a matter of preference.
And you find it works the best for you?
It works the best for me. I don't have to feed it or take it to the doctor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Get it shots or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm not emotionally attached to it.
And I bet it saved your life a couple times.
It has. Having been in Philadelphia, and which is where I'm from, and having lived in New York where streets are kind of, you know, a challenge to cross, they are very much a challenge to cross here. We could have done this walk anywhere. We could have done it in a memorial in University over there by, Beach and University over by Memorial Hospital or by Shands, anywhere. But we chose this area because that Five Points area is, you know, heavy, you know, volume of people that go through there. So it's a challenge.
Sure. So keep your eyes peeled for those white canes, especially this Thursday, because there will be events around the state, not just here in Jacksonville.
Yes.
Doug Hansard of the local council for the blind. A pleasure to meet you. And thanks for educating not just me, but all of our listeners.
I'd also like to say, too, that over there in the white in the Five Points area, we'd like to see an audible box put in that area, an audible crossing thing put in that area to allow persons with visual impairment to know when to cross the street. There's not enough of those in mm-hmm. this area. And so we're hoping to see that happen as well. And for those who are visually impaired and are looking for a group to come to, we at the Jacksonville Council of the Blind meet on the third Monday of the month. We have a meeting coming up on the 19th. We meet at 3197 Cortez Road. That's 3197 Cortez Road. It's the Brooks Clubhouse. We meet from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And basically, we come together to meet and discuss issues that are pertinent for blind and visually impaired. So come on out and join us, if you will. That's the Brooks Clubhouse.
Excellent. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you so much.
And I hope the FDOT was listening, too. Maybe they were. Keep me posted.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much. God bless.
You too. Well, finally this hour, she's the winner of The Square. That's WJCT's collaboration with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville and the local arts community, a place for artists to share their work with the public. Digital designer and fine artist Brenda Cato won the most votes this time around for her submission to The Square. Her piece, Yoga Backbend. It's a modern batik featuring the vibrational energy of a woman doing a classic yoga pose. Brenda Cato, congratulations. Welcome to Studio 5.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a beautiful piece. What was the inspiration for it?
So I'm really into energy art and showing energy fields through color. And yoga is a classic form of energy work that you can do. But my first fascination came from studying cymatics, which is the study of patterns that music make. And looking into, like, what they call it, sacred geometry and fractal patterns in physics. So I have a fascination with that type of thing.
Now, it's interesting to note that you received your BFA in illustration from the Ringling School of Art and Design.
Yes.
You literally went to the circus.
Exactly. They do actually have a clown college.
That's right. You actually did go to that school. And so you're a talented designer, animator, art director, and this form of batik, what is it about that genre that attracts you?
So it's a kind of a mashup of an old style, but I call it modern because I'm using different techniques to make it. The original version, you use a wax release method to create your image, and I use different paints and a different technique to create still an antique look, but it's not traditional black batik, so I call it a modern batik.
Your work is going to be featured not only at wjct.org/thesquare, you can look at it on our website, we will have it on television as well, but it will be featured in the new Players by the Sea production in November, is that right?
That's right. Come out and see me and the other winners of The Square. We will all be displaying there.
Pretty exciting. The next round of submissions to The Square, we need you guys, everyone listening, to send them in by November 30th. It's exciting to see all the submissions. There's such a vibrant arts community here.
The community here of artists is huge, very talented, and I commend whoever's idea The Square was because it is a great way for the arts to get some press coverage, which is kind of hard in this town unless you're doing something scandalous. And so it's a great way for artists to be able to, by popular vote, get some press coverage, and of course your show is awesome.
People can look at this on our website or on your website, which is
brendacato.com.
What are you working on right now?
So right now, if you'll come out to the show, you can see some of this. I also have, besides energy work, I have Day of the Dead art, which is very popular now, too.
Oh, that's right. And with Halloween coming up, too.
Yes, exactly.
Ooh, a little spooky. She's the winner of our contest, our collaboration with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, The Square. Go online to our website, wjct.org/thesquare, to see Brenda Cato's winning submission, Yoga Backbend. Check out all of the winners' work at the new Players by the Sea show. And if you have any kind of piece of art you'd like to submit, submit it to our website. The next round is due by November 30th. It's a way to showcase the many talents of this area's artistic community. Brenda, a pleasure, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Questions or comments, go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, the U.S., Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea have emerged as major players in the new world of cyber warfare. A look at global security threats posed by increasingly sophisticated malware and the new digital arms race. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.